Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. May be seated. First case on our calendar is 08905 and 1009. Lily Alexander, Shelton Coleman versus Wells Fargo and American General Financial Services. Mr. King.
Good morning. My name is Scott King. May it please the court, I will be speaking on behalf of Wells Fargo Financial. Monica Lax will be speaking on behalf of American General. We'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The issue in this appeal is whether the 8th District improperly created exceptions to the test for arbitrability, which this court enunciated in Academy of Medicine of Cincinnati versus Aetna Health. Because the 8th District's exceptions conflict with both the spirit and the letter of Aetna Health, its decision should be overruled. Under Aetna Health, courts are required to refer matters to arbitration unless they can be maintained without reference to the contract or the underlying relationship with the contract created.
The contracts involved, I assume, a note.
And a loan agreement, yes, Your Honor.
Yes, and an application.
Yes, Your Honor.
The required disclosure statements and the statements that are given to the person receiving the funds showing the distribution and a mortgage, right?
All of those documents would be part of the relationship created by the contract.
Were there any additional documents?
In this particular case, the lien, the mortgage. But all the documents that you mentioned would be part and parcel of the underlying relationship. Right.
And did any of them discuss in any manner the procedure to be followed when the loan had been paid in full with respect to the release of the mortgage?
No, Your Honor, none of the documents spoke to the direct answer to your question. They didn't say upon payment the security agreement or the mortgage would be released. However, that is an implied obligation the law imposed and imposed prior to the existence of 5301.36.
The statute imposes an obligation that is the subject matter of this dispute.
With respect, Your Honor, the statute imposes the obligation to release the mortgage within 90 days. There is a contractual obligation separate and apart from the statute to release the mortgage. It is an implied obligation under the contract. As an example, Your Honor, if on the 89th day there was a closing to be scheduled, but the mortgage had not been released, and as a result of the mortgage not being released, the closing cratered, the borrower would have a claim against the lender independent of the statute that arises as an implied obligation under the contract. So the obligation to release the mortgage is one that's implied by law within the instrument.
So we have an implied implied obligation to arbitrate.
No, Your Honor, that's not correct. The implied obligation is the obligation to release the lien. The loan agreement, even if it doesn't expressly say that upon payment the lien will be released, that obligation is implied within the agreement. The arbitration agreement is an express agreement, and the loan agreement in this particular case expressly refers to the arbitration agreement itself.
The real question is, I think, whether or not the language of the arbitration agreement is applicable to the statutory sanction for failure to release the mortgage.
I agree that is the real question in this particular case, because the claim asserted is only for violation of the statute, but Your Honor is correct.
Is there a difference then between the case that you're presenting on behalf of Wells Fargo in connection with the mortgage and the failure to satisfy that, and the American General case, where the obligation there was to file a termination statement for the financing agreement?
Your Honor, I believe that the difference in the obligations relate to timing. the statutes impose.
Well, one is 90 days for the mortgage and 30 days for the termination statement.
Correct.
But when I reviewed the language of the arbitration agreement in the financing situation, there's a section that relates to any claim or dispute arising under any federal or state statute. Doesn't that specifically control the statutory obligation to release the financing statement?
That would cover that obligation.
But you don't have that language in the mortgage situation.
That is true. However, the mortgage agreement is just as broad by saying that it would include all disputes arising or related to the agreement without delineating the types of disputes those could be.
So your argument is that the language that says all claims or disputes arising out of, relating to, or in connection with is broad enough to incorporate arbitration of the statutory obligation to release the mortgage.
That is correct, Your Honor. Plus, there's one other facet to the arbitration agreement in the Wells Fargo case, which is that it includes prior and future dealings as well. So it's not merely all those that arise or relate, but it also has an express reference to future dealings.
And is that what you're hanging your hat on, or do you think that this is related to the loan?
I think it is related to the loan, even if the future dealings clause wasn't there, but the future dealings clause clarifies that it was intended to reach disputes beyond the initial initial formulation of the loan.
What has your research shown countrywide as to the application of this language in other jurisdictions?
Your Honor, that language has been construed to encompass claims under Magnuson-Moss, under Truth in Lending, under the Consumer Sales Practices Act. I am not aware of any case that applies it to a mortgage release statute.
So we're pretty much limited in this case to an interpretation of what that language means and whether or not it encompasses that statutory duty.
Your Honor, I think that you can draw on the precedent from the Supreme Court of the United States as well as this Court's own precedents to construe that language in light of the presumption of arbitrability, in light of the breadth of the language. But there is no case that will give you the precise answer to whether or not this statute is covered by that language. But I think the general principles mandate the conclusion that it is.
I'm sure your opposing counsel would suggest that there's nothing in the agreement, in the loan agreements, that relate at all to releasing it.
He may suggest that, Your Honor, but that is not correct, and it's not correct for a number of reasons. First, the claim here requires evidence that there was a payoff of the underlying loan agreement. You can't tell whether there has actually been a payoff without reference to the terms of the underlying loan agreement to include the amount of the payments that were to be made as well as the applicable interest rates. So this particular claim requires reference to the contract itself. In addition, under the test in Academy of Medicine versus Aetna Health, it requires reference to the underlying relationship, not only the express terms of the loan agreement, but the relationship which are created. Both of those facts would suggest that it's arbitrable.
The issue here seems to be whether or not we file an action in a court of general jurisdiction or whether the matter goes to arbitration.
Correct.
And that issue, the larger issue, is whether or not there can then be a class action asserted in the Common Pleas Court or the Court of General Jurisdiction for all similarly situated individuals who find themselves in the situation of having paid off a mortgage but not obtaining a release.
Your Honor, that is the larger issue. The trial court found that the arbitration agreement was enforceable in that context. The Court of Appeals didn't get to that issue, but that is the larger issue ultimately in the case.
Is it possible to have a class action arbitration in your view?
It is, Your Honor, yes, it is possible when the rules of the AAA permit that, but in this particular case, the agreement does not.
So it is the limiting language of the agreement that would preclude a class action arbitration of this issue, in your view?
Yes, Your Honor, because the language of the agreement controls the scope of and the procedures for arbitration.
Thank you, Mr. King.
You're into lax time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. King. Lax.
Good morning, Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Monica Lax. I'm with the firm of McGlinchey Stafford, and I represent American General Financial Services and the consolidated appeal of Coleman versus American General. While Alexander concerned a claim for failure to file a satisfaction of mortgage, Coleman is slightly different in that it concerns a claim for failure to file a termination statement under Chapter 1309 of the revised code. And this court needs to determine today whether, in the context of these secured transactions, the 8th District ignored existing law and created a new standard, which I will call the Academy of Medicine / Pinchot standard, and diluted the existing standard of this court in determining the arbitrability of these claims. It is undisputed between the parties. Both of the parties have argued in their merit briefs that Academy of Medicine is the standard for determining arbitrability of these claims. That is, whether a borrower's claim can be maintained without reference to the loan agreement or to the relationship between the parties, which in this case is a debtor-creditor relationship. And it's also undisputed that the arbitration clauses in both of the cases before your honors today are the broadest possible clauses, that they both include every possible claim arising out of or related to the loan agreements.
Actually, your clause seems to me to be much broader. It's more specific, and therefore it seems to me it's broader than the clause in the Alexander case, is it not?
It does have some broader terminology in it. You're correct, Your Honor. It applies to statutory claims specifically, although I would add that in the United States Supreme Court in Mitsubishi Motors stated that if an arbitration agreement does not specifically exclude a statutory claim, then that statutory claim is presumed to be included. And our clause also includes all claims that arise even after the loan has been paid in full, while the other includes a future dealings clause. But these clauses are the paradigm of a broad clause, as this court has stated. So at its core, the question before this court is whether the claim for failure to file a termination statement in this case under Chapter 1309 can be maintained without reference to that loan agreement or the relationship between the parties. And that is where the two parties differ, and that is where the 8th District created a new, narrower standard.
Are you relying principally on that broad language of the arbitration agreement, claims or disputes arising out of, in connection with, or relating to the loan? Or are you more concentrating on the language that says any claim or dispute arising under a federal or state statute?
I think it could fall under either, Your Honor. It's certainly related to the loan agreement, but the parties also expressly agreed that statutory claims would be included. So it goes beyond the any and all language, and it expressly includes statutory claims as well, so that there can be no dispute that this type of claim is included.
Does this agreement also contain a preclusion of a class action lawsuit at the arbitration level?
It does contain a class action waiver.
I would like to explore just a moment how this arbitration would work. I believe there's, for the borrower, there's an initial $125 filing fee. Let's assume that the borrower had paid the loan, the financing statement was not released on time. Would we necessarily assume then that the arbitration would be in favor of the borrower?
Well, initially, I don't think the court needs to visit, or the court cannot visit the merits of the claim.
I understand this is sort of a tangential issue, but let's assume the borrower wins the arbitration. Does the arbitrator award that initial deposit cost to the borrower to be reimbursed? I don't know what it costs to release a financing statement, but I don't know if it's $125. My question is it going to cost the borrower $125 to enter into arbitration, in which they might as well have paid to do it themselves?
That could be the case. It's the arbitration agreement provides that the $125 fee would initially be paid by the borrower and that the lender pays anything in excess of the $125. I'd have to look at the arbitration clause more closely, and certainly we can inform the court. I can look at the fine print and see whether there's any reimbursement of that provision in the event that the borrower prevails at the
I didn't find anything in the document itself. I didn't know if the arbitration procedure provided
under the FAA rules. I don't know the answer to that, and we can certainly get back to you, Your Honor.
Counsel, in this procedure, the amount to be recovered is what under the statute?
I believe it's $250.
Same as the release of a mortgage.
I think it's $500.
Justice O'Donnell asked Mr. King about a number of possibilities. I'm wondering what you think the chances are for individuals who find that these releases have not been timely made to be able to employ a lawyer one at a time individually to bring an action or bring an arbitration for them to recover what they're statutorily entitled to.
Certainly, there's an expense involved in litigation. There's an expense involved in arbitration. In our case, the Court of Common Pleas did not even visit the class action issue, and nor did the 8th District.
Well, the chances are between slim and none, aren't they, that any individual is going to be able to hire a lawyer to get this. So what you're offering up is a complete defense to the statute, effectively.
Well, certainly there's an expense involved, but I don't think that that necessarily corrects the new law that the 8th District created.
Well, we have
situation.
New law all the time designed to fit unique and special situations. And what you're presenting us with, it seems to me, from a practical standpoint, is if there can be no class action, and I'm not a big fan of class actions, but if there can be no class action, effectively there'll never be a recovery under the statute.
Well, if this case were decided,
hence the need for perhaps carving out a niche.
There may ultimately be a niche to be carved out eventually, but I don't believe that that's the question before this court today.
Let me ask you about the Pinchot case. I know both sides have argued that appellants have argued that it dealt with the preemption issue, but there is some language in Pinchot, is there not, that is a hurdle for you to get over?
I think and Your Honor, are you referring to the language that states that I'm
Go,
at my
can,
rebuttal
you,
time?
You may respond.
The language, Pinchot states that the claims in that case was not integrally related to the lending process. Is that the language you're referring to?
Yes.
Okay. I think there's an important distinction here. First of all, that was a preemption case, and the standard under preemption is extremely narrow, while the standard under arbitration is extremely broad. The burden of proof lies with the opposite party in each case. And we are not, this court need not determine whether the claims presented by the parties in these cases are integrally related to the lending process. It simply need determine whether they can be made without reference to the loan agreement, not the lending process, or the relationship again between the parties.
Okay.
And with that, I will turn the podium over.
Thank you, Ms. Lax. Mr. Perotti.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Patrick Perotti with Dworkin and Bernstein, and I'm here for the appellees on both cases with my co-counsel, Brian Rochelle. Before I start my arguments, I'd like to mention something that Justice Pfeiffer mentioned, and I think that someone else mentioned it, and that is, I totally agree with the other side, although I'd like it to be, the issue of the substantive rights under an arbitration clause, if it applies, are not before the court. In the Coleman case, the trial judge did not rule on that, Judge First did not rule on that, and the Court of Appeals indicated in its opinion at page 70 of the appendix, that we do not address the underlying issues of unconscionability or public policy as those issues are moot under Appellate Rule 12A1C. In the Wells Fargo case, likewise, the trial court did get to issues A, B, and C. They said the clause is applicable. I find it not unconscionable. I find it not to be against public policy. But our 8th District Court of Appeals said, now that we've found it inapplicable, we don't reach issues B and C. So we would suggest that if you were to reverse the cases today, then in the Coleman case, it must go back to the trial court to make a ruling on that issue. And in the Wells Fargo case, Alexander, it must go back to the 8th District Court of Appeals to make a ruling on exactly what Justice Pfeiffer said, and that is what this court said in In Re Consolidated Mortgages litigation, and that is no one would bring an individual claim with a lawyer, either in this case it would be in arbitration or in court, without the class action device, because as Justice Posner, or Judge Posner so colorfully stated in one of his opinions, this isn't a question of one suit versus 17 million suits. It's a question of no suits, because only a fool or an idiot sues over $30. And that's the case here. No one brings those cases.
But our question is a legal question, is it not?
Absolutely. Your question is the Aetna standard. And in this case, there are, let's talk.
You both say it applies.
Say it again?
You both say Aetna applies.
We do say Aetna applies. And in this case, in the transaction involving the Alexanders, there were three documents they signed. They signed a promissory note, they signed an arbitration clause, and they signed a mortgage. The arbitration clause specifically incorporates the note. It does not incorporate the mortgage. It could have incorporated the mortgage, but they didn't write it that way. These folks wrote it a little bit broader to encompass statutory claims. I'll get to that in a minute. I don't think that that still does it based on the record here, but they didn't do that in Wells Fargo. And the key is that the Aetna standard says that if the underlying lawsuit, 530136, if that lawsuit can be decided without reference to, in this case, to the note, then the arbitration clause would not apply to it. And I have to disagree with my opposing counsel, who said that the question here is whether the standard is Aetna. She said that because in the briefing, they take the Aetna standard, and with due respect to the members of the court here who were dissents in Aetna, they suggested a but-for standard, that but for the relationship, you would not have a lawsuit. And the majority of this court rejected that. And they said that is not the rule. They rejected the argument that the dissent said in Aetna, but the Coors Brewing case. In the Coors Brewing case, we had a situation where there was a license agreement. It was a contract between Coors and Molson. Suddenly, Molson runs out, and they enter into a contract with Miller. A lawsuit is then brought for antitrust, for a restraint of trade. Now, but for that license agreement, you wouldn't have had the underlying lawsuit. There's no question about that. But this court said that is not encompassed in the arbitration clause because you don't look to any of the terms of those licensing agreements to decide the suit that's now in litigation. And in our case, if you were to look at the note, we have the note here. If you were to look at the note, you were to say, what do we have here that would help us in a 530136 case? And the answer is nothing. Let's take some examples. Let's take an example.
Except that the statute, the duty in the statute begins when the note is satisfied, doesn't it?
Exactly.
So you have to have, there's a relationship to the note in the statute, is there not?
No, there isn't. Because, and the reason is, the question, again, the question isn't whether there's a relation, whether the note creates a relationship without which you wouldn't have a mortgage and you wouldn't have the statute. The question is, are there any terms in the note that we could look at? anything about that document, those terms, those conditions, that we would look at to decide the underlying mortgage release case? And the answer is you wouldn't. Let's say we have a mortgage. Pat Perotti has
What would you be looking at? You would be looking at some document from the lender.
You want to know the answer to that is, and my opposing counsel, I've had him in many cases on these exact issues, and he will tell you, if he comes back up on reply, he will admit that we never, in any of those cases, and there's been dozens of them, ever look at the promissory notes. This is what we look at right here. This is in Curry versus City Financial. This one is in Rosetta versus Countrywide, decided by this court. This is in Piro versus National City Bank. This is in Altshuler versus Sky Bank. This is in Countrywide. And these are documents that are printed up by the bank from their computer system. And those documents contain the name and address and something called a payoff date. And that's the only thing we look at. Those come from the bank's records because the bank doesn't look at the note and its language to decide when payments were made or when they weren't.
But the bank had to look at those original documents to create the summaries that you refer to. So you still have to have, I mean, you can't prove that that note wasn't paid off if the bank didn't have the original documents to show that.
We don't.
That you don't have it doesn't mean that the bank doesn't have that document and showed it was paid off before it created the summaries that you're referring to. And the fact that you don't need that in court or the judge doesn't require it in court, the judge could. The judge could say, I don't trust those documents. I want to see the original note.
No, because we've brought the lawsuit for 530136 relief, and all we have to do is we have to show a payoff and the date of release. And we show a payoff by showing the bank's records, which are binding as an admission on them. That's their record. They can't deny that for John Smith, his mortgage was paid off on January 1st. And let me get through some.
I think what you're confusing, and the reason we have these questions, is that the statute doesn't go to whatever documents you have. The statute goes to a liability on the part of the bank.
The statute goes to a date.
And it doesn't. Liability doesn't begin until there's been a payoff of a note. Regardless of how you refer to it in your records, it's a legal obligation, is it not, imposed by statute. And it begins at some point in time.
Exactly.
And how do we determine when that point in time has arrived?
If it's a 30-year loan under the note, and I pay off in 20 years, can you see that by looking at the note? Oh. Reading that note until you're blue in the face won't tell you that loan is paid off. The only place you will find that is in the bank's records. And that's not based on the term of the note. That's based on the bank has an accounting record that calculates the amount of the payments, and it's right there. And it says $30,000 loaned, $29,600, $29,300, and it keeps going down with principal and interest, and eventually it reaches a zero.
But that's just your method of establishing the payoff. That's not the underlying legal obligation that creates the payoff date, creates the terms of the payoff. That still is the underlying evidence that gets you to the bank payoff documents.
But you, with due respect, Your Honor, it doesn't get me to the bank payoff documents because, again, in this suit, if I decide whether Mr. Pfeiffer or Mr. O'Donnell or anybody on the bench, anyone in the United States, anyone in the country has a paid off mortgage, I don't look at this document here, which is the promissory note. It doesn't tell me that. The evidence, and the question in Aetna is my lawsuit, 530136, does it require us to look ever to the underlying contract in order to determine liability? And the answer is no. We prove these by saying the bank admitted for these borrowers that this is the payoff date. We don't question that date. It's what it is. And if it's because, let's say, there's a payoff with a delayed settlement, the mortgage note document doesn't know what date the settlement will be. It doesn't know if it's going to be January 1st or March 1st. Whenever it happens, and they then enter that into a record, and that's the record we use to prove the case. And with due respect, we think that that's what Aetna says. We think that Aetna says that you decide whether you have to look at any of the terms in the underlying, in this case, the underlying note, in order to determine the lawsuit that is now being litigated by the parties.
How do you explain the future dealings phrase that exists in one of the bank documents? How do you explain why that would not apply to this scenario?
This isn't a future dealing. The dealing has, for the mortgage already occurred 30 years ago. The mortgage was entered into 30 years ago. If they wanted to make that mortgage subject to an arbitration clause, they could have put that arbitration clause saying, this encompasses any matter relating to the note or any matter arising out of the mortgage. They didn't do that. And this court,
if we accept your interpretation of future dealings. So future dealings can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. That's a pretty broad phrase.
Future dealings, yes. Future dealings could be interpreted, for example, in this case with Wells Fargo. It could be interpreted that if Mrs. Alexander walks into Wells Fargo 20 years later and slips and falls on ice inside of the lobby or a broken step, she can't sue them. She has to go to arbitration.
That's getting a little extreme. I'm sorry.
But that is a future dealing.
Yeah, but that's not a future dealing. It's directly related to the note, which talks about paying off the mortgage.
But that's not the way their clause is worded. According to him, their clause is anything relating or arising out of the note or any prior or future dealings between the parties. It's disjunctive. It's separate.
Well, counsel, isn't it foreseeable that there's going to be a release filed?
Absolutely.
And that would be one of the things that we would look at in trying to define the future dealings. And the example that you just gave of somebody slipping on a broken step, that's not part of the future dealings concept when we're only actually trying to figure out the future dealings within the four corners of the document that is the subject of the relationship between the borrower and the lender. And it is without question, foreseeable that there's going to be a payoff of that obligation. And if there's a payoff of that obligation, there's going to be a release.
Yes.
All right. And yes. Why does it get more complicated than that?
It doesn't get more complicated than that. Again, the drafter of this agreement knew that there was going to be a release. They wrote it the way they wrote it. The UCC company wrote it to include all statutory issues and everything else. The bank didn't. And the bank wrote it the way it said, and it said, we incorporate and we reference the note, not the mortgage. And this
are you suggesting that the statutory language that was incorporated by American General precludes recovery of your client?
Because in other words, requires arbitration?
Statute? Yes.
No, because we believe that if you look at the statutory language provision, we think that an arbitration agreement isn't a free-floating dragnet that just pulls you in case you ever had a relationship with this entity.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm sorry.
Let me finish his answer to Justice
O'Donnell's
question.
Yeah, let me finish his and that then. And it requires you to then go back to Aetna. And Aetna says you need to look not at the general relationship between the parties. You need to look at whether there's a necessity of any type. It's very broad, to look at the underlying agreement, and that is the note. And the answer is there isn't, because in this case, the note doesn't tell us the date of the payoff. And the only two elements that are relevant in a 530136 litigation is putting in front of the court a date of payoff, which is their admission. We don't need to prove anything else of that. And going to the county, and this court said that in Ray Consolidated. This court says how you explain how you prove it. You said you go to the bank's record, and you look at the payoff date, and then you go to the county recorder, and you look at the day of the release. And then you add and see if there's 90 days between the two of them.
Mr. Perotti,
yes,
talking about Aetna, it seems that you want to insert the words terms of the contract. When we were looking at Fazio and the majority said that you're talking about reference to the contract or the relationship at issue. And when I listen to your explanation or your view of Aetna, it seems that you're saying you must look to the terms of the contract itself.
No, because there was a question by Justice O'Donnell at the very beginning, or Justice Pfeiffer asked, does the mortgage say anything about an obligation to release the lien? And my opposing counsel indicated that it didn't, and in fact it does.
But it's an either-or, contract or the relationship,
exactly.
Correct?
And the contract is, again, if I could answer both parts of that question, the contract is what the contract says. I mean, because a contract isn't simply a word, it's an agreement. And so do you look at that contract, do you look at anything in that contract at all in order to determine my lawsuit? And the answer is no. If we talk about relationship, then I respectfully believe that gets back to the but-for argument that they're making, which was exactly what was asked by the dissent in Aetna but was not accepted by the majority. Because if you, here's the note. The note doesn't say anything. It's in their exhibits, and they provided it with an affidavit of Janice Yori Edmondson, and they attached it to the record in the trial court. And the promissory note, which is their exhibit one, that doesn't say anything about what happens at the end of payment, because it doesn't say the date payment is to be ended. It doesn't say when the payoff date is. But the mortgage does. The mortgage is a single-page thing called a statutory mortgage under 5302.14. And it says that if the amounts of principal and interest secured by the mortgage are paid off and the taxes and everything else, then the mortgage shall be void. And that's it. And that's what says the same thing that the statute says, and that is when this is over, you release it. And how do we know when it was released? We know from there. Or when it was paid off, we know from there. And how do we know when it was released? We know from the county's records. And so essentially what we have here is we have a situation where the agreement for arbitration is not as broad as possible. It's broader in her transaction than it is in his transaction, but it's not as broad as possible. And as broad as possible would be for us now as the court to rewrite the agreement for them and to put in the language or arising out of the security agreement in her case, and in his case, arising out of the mortgage. But that's not what it says. And what it says under Aetna is that we have a note, we have a mortgage, and we have an arbitration agreement, and you decide the lawsuit that I'm bringing without any reference to the note and only with reference to the mortgage. There's no other questions. I would again ask the court to affirm the decisions of the 8th District, and if you do not, I would ask that in Coleman it be sent back to the trial judge to make rulings on the conscionability and public policy validity of the class action ban and the arbitration clause, and in Alexander it's sent back to the Court of Appeals to rule on those issues.
Thank you, Mr. Perotti. Mr. King, you saved a minute of your time.
I will be brief. The arbitration clause in this case includes any claim in contract, tort, or otherwise, so it includes otherwise, which would reach statutory claims as well as claims of any variety, shape, or form. Justice Pfeiffer asked about whether you needed a lawyer to bring this case. You don't. All you need to bring this case is to show that the loan had been paid off and it was not satisfied within, or the mortgage was not filed within the requisite time. Claims like that are brought in small claims court every day. This is a case for $250 in one hand, $500 in another. Those amounts are the type of amounts that can be brought in small claims.
Counsel, what is the actual practice with the institutions here? If I'm a former borrower and I say you haven't released my, you haven't filed the appropriate release within the appropriate amount of days, and I notify the bank, is it challenged, or do you normally just acquiesce and say, you're right, we goofed, and here's your damages?
There's nothing in the record that suggests the frequency with which this occurs. In this particular case, the loan was refinanced. It's not in the record, but it's within the public records. But the answer, Your Honor, is that I'm not aware that it occurs with any frequency such that I would know the answer to your question, ultimately. Two more quote points very briefly. Justice Langsinger all hit this. Their reading of Aetna ignores the relationship branch. It's, you can't look at Aetna and say it has to relate to the contract. It relates to the contract or the relationship. Lastly, the court did not
reach. Let me just stop you there. In the Alexander agreement, is there a relationship language? I don't see it.
No, Your Honor, the relationship language is within the Aetna test. Either it has to be proven without reference to the contract or the relationship.
The Coleman agreement refers to that language, rising under any federal or state statute, based on arising, that's at the tail end, as you know, but,
yeah.
But
that's. Your Honor, with respect, the Alexander language, by saying contract, tort, or otherwise, is arguably broader than the Coleman language because it includes otherwise without requiring a delineation of what that otherwise.
Yeah, the word otherwise is really a, it seems like almost a throwaway word, doesn't it? Give people rights and responsibilities, and you say otherwise?
Your Honor, with respect, I think that it reflects an intention to capture everything. So it was contract, tort, or otherwise. whatever list we could give you, there was always going to be some other claim that we could tack on to the end that we didn't include. Ultimately, I think the answer to the question falls in the arising under or related to language itself. The last point, the Aetna court did not reject the but-for test. The words but-for appear nowhere in the opinion. Justice Langzinger advocated the touch-upon test from Fazio, but the court never addressed the but-for test, and for statutory claims, that test is particularly appropriate. If you wouldn't have a statutory claim but for the contract or the relationship created, that is a key that tells you that the dispute is arbitrable.
Thank you, Mr. King. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.